As a humanitarian aid worker, Kenneth Gluck has traveled in many countries devastated by war, Tajikistan, the Sudan, Liberia, and Afghanistan, but he never experienced direct personal danger before Chechnya. On January 9th, while working on a project for Doctors Without Borders in a suburb of Grozny, Gluck was kidnapped at gunpoint and detained for 26 days. 11 of those days he spent in a tiny cellar storage area. The identity of his captors is still unknown. Doctors Without Borders has suspended aid to Chechnya since Gluck's detention, but report they plan to resume their project soon. When I spoke with Kenneth Gluck last week, I asked him how the kidnapping went down on January 9th.
Well, that day we were in the Stariatagi Hospital. Stariatagi is a town in central Chechnya, about 20 kilometers south of Grozny. And it's a place where we've done a lot of work, so I know the people there very well. We were actually finished for the day. We were leaving the hospital in the early afternoon so that we could get back to our base in Ingushetia by nightfall. And we were in a four-car convoy when a car cut us off. Four men with Kalashnikovs, masks, jumped out and surrounded my car and pulled me out. It was all over very quickly. Unfortunately, we were having kind of an animated discussion in the car when it happened, so I didn't even catch the first 15 seconds or so of the attack, and by then it was really over.
I think you got injured. You got hit in the back of the head. How did that happen?
That was actually after they pulled me out of the car. They were dragging me to their car, and they were continuing to fire, and I tried to look back to see what was happening with the people in the convoy. Some of them were very close friends of mine, and they thought I was resisting, so they hit me once over the back of the head with a rifle butt, which, if I had any doubts, convinced me not to resist any further.
They took you into a house, into a cellar of a house. What were your basic conditions like?
Well, we got to the house where I would spend the rest of the 25 days. The very first night, and they put me in a cellar. It's a root cellar. Pretty much most houses in Chechnya or in southern Russia have these things. It's used for storing potatoes and onions and cabbage for the winter. This one was about 40 inches high, so you could just barely sit up. And there was a mattress, some blankets, along with the potatoes and onions and garlic, carrots, and cabbage that most people store.
Is that what you ate?
No, they would bring me out of the basement three times a day to feed me in the beginning, and the food was uninteresting, but sufficient.
You spent 11 days in that cellar. Did you have anything with you to do or to read?
Well, I was fortunate in that I was able to take my bag with me when I was kidnapped. So I had a book. A long book with me in the basement, which I spent most of my time doing. It was on the second or the third day when the guards gave me a kerosene lamp so that I could read.
What was the book?
The book is A History of the Arab Peoples by Albert Hwarani, which I read several times.
You were talking to your guards. What kind of information did they give you about why you were being held captive?
They never really gave me any information about why, but like I said, around the second week, their attitude towards me started to improve. At a certain point, it was really one guard I was mostly dealing with. He was very apologetic. At one point, he said he's ashamed to stand in front of me, and he realizes what they did was impermissible. I don't know why this happened. This is around the same time that they gave me a radio to listen to, which was nice. But we think that the people we've been working with, the people in the hospitals and clinics, they were getting in touch with everybody they could to say that this is something that's intolerable, to tell people about the kind of assistance we had been providing over the last year, and in a way to plead my case. It's one of the nice things about doctors and nurses is that everybody gets sick, so they know people on all sides of the conflict, and they have generally treated somebody's mother, somebody's cousin from any part of the society. So they were in touch with people from all around the conflict.
After 11 days in the cellar, they let you come up to the upstairs of the house and live there. You listened to the radio. Did you hear reports of your capture?
Well, they brought me, being moved out of the cellar into a room in the house was a gradual thing. They gradually let me stay more and more upstairs until they let me sleep there. I heard lots of reports about myself. I didn't get the radio until probably, again, 10 or 11 days into the kidnapping. So I think there had been a decline in the news coverage, but sure, there were still things on on BBC, on RFI. There was no NPR in that part of the world.
What happened when they finally let you go?
Well, from the very beginning, really, from the first day of the kidnapping, I had been telling them, just let me go to any hospital. All of the hospitals know us. We trust all of the hospitals. Said either drop me off at a hospital or drop me off at the house of a head doctor. And in the end, that's what they did. I was taken out. It was the evening of February 3rd, and they took me out at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Again, drove me about an hour in two different cars. And eventually they stopped in a place, and they did seem to be very apologetic. They apologized many times, saying that had been a mistake. And when I was still very nervous. I still hadn't really believed that they were going to release me until they started returning all of my documents. So they returned my my Doctors Without Borders ID card, my driver's license. They returned the military passes that we had received from the Russians. And they returned $700 in cash, which was maybe one of the more shocking pieces that had been in my pocket when I was kidnapped. The only thing they didn't return was a watch, and they said that we're sorry we can't find your watch. I didn't really mind. It cost about $7, and I told them not to worry about it. And after that, they took me out of the car. I still didn't know where I was because I was still blindfolded, and they pushed me through the gate of a house. And it turns out that this was a house of a doctor who I was very friendly with. I had stayed in his house in the past, and he had already come out hearing that there were people in front of his house. And he said to me, first in Chechen, which I didn't understand, and then in Russian, who are you, since I had a mask over my face? And I was too stunned to really answer. I didn't know what to answer in any case. And he actually reached over and lifted up the mask, and then I realized it was an old friend of mine.
There's widespread speculation that it was Russian forces that arranged for your detention. And an obvious motivation would be to encourage humanitarian groups to pull out of Chechnya, that this was a faked kidnapping, and it was a good way to shut down the whole humanitarian mission. Did you buy that? Do you buy that scenario?
We don't know. Unfortunately, because of it sounds silly, but the kidnappers never introduced themselves. They never said who they are, and if they did, I wouldn't necessarily have believed them. We still don't know who organized the kidnapping or why. We do know that there would be no reason for either side in this conflict to have kidnapped us. They both knew exactly what we were up to. We always try to work very openly. Any Chechen hospital could have told them exactly what we're doing, and we always traveled well-marked. They knew where we were going, and both sides knew about us because of our work in the past and because of our reputation. The Russians certainly knew us because we do a lot of work in Russia outside of Chechnya. There are very large tuberculosis control projects in Siberia that are done very closely with the Russian government. There are AIDS control programs and programs providing health care for homeless people in Moscow and St. Petersburg. It's not as if we're an unknown quantity to the Russian government or to the rebels.
I'm talking with Kenneth Gluck. He's a humanitarian aid worker for Doctors Without Borders. He was abducted in Chechnya on January 9th, spent 26 days in captivity. We'll talk more after break. This is Fresh Air. Back with humanitarian aid worker Kenneth Gluck. While working for Doctors Without Borders in Chechnya in January, he was kidnapped and held for 26 days. His captors have never been identified. Could you talk more about the humanitarian situation in Chechnya? You were working in hospitals. What kind of supplies did they have? What were they like?
Well, the hospitals in Chechnya, many of them have been devastated by the bombing, particularly the hospitals in Grozny, in some of the more mountainous areas as well. The Vidino Hospital, for example, it really had 7 of its 10 wards were completely flattened. In the pediatric hospital number 2 in Grozny, I think there's only one wall left standing. A place like that is not functioning anymore. The pediatric hospital number 2 has had to move and just take over an abandoned building, which they're now gradually repairing, putting in heat, and starting to work. The doctors in places like this have been working sometimes for long periods of time with no medical inputs. So if you're brought in wounded into a Chechen hospital, very often the first thing they'll tell the relatives who bring in a wounded person is, these are the things you have to find. Go find them and we'll start operating. Sometimes the doctors will have a small private stash of their own for emergency cases, but unfortunately they're really not having the equipment they need.
What kind of care are the doctors and also you aid workers able to administer in Chechnya in the hospitals under such challenging conditions?
Well, it's actually a phenomenon, but in some of these half-destroyed hospitals, they're doing very sophisticated surgery. They do it with old half-destroyed equipment that they've managed to fix. A lot of doctors hid their instruments during the bombing, including some of them buried them. I was in one place. It's literally a bomb shelter where they had essentially an underground operating theater going on for months. These are some of the most experienced war surgeons around. They've dealt with so much war trauma over the last 5 or 6 years that they've developed ways of operating in these conditions. So there's really I think that's one of the things that shocked our doctors at our borders, doctors who came in, is to what extent that they had managed to keep sophisticated healthcare going in horrible circumstances.
Do you feel any lasting residue from your experience? Any, I don't know, dreams? Or when you have a quiet moment, does your mind go back to what you experienced?
I certainly spent a lot of time thinking about mistakes that I made, that my team made, which allowed us to get kidnapped. You know, most of what sticks in my mind is really the people who did all of these things to get me out, and who really suffered that period. Probably, I think, more than I did. There's one friend of mine, also a Chechen doctor, who I saw the night I finally got back to the Doctors Without Borders office in Ingushetia, and he really looked like he had aged 20 years just in that 1 month. And I felt that I was feeling much better than he was during that period.
In your career as an aid worker, have you suffered burnout?
These are situations where you need a break from. But you always come back to, you're always in a way motivated by the people you work with. I'm on vacation now. They said, okay, you've had a rough time. Go and take a month in New York. The Chechen doctors I'm working with, they can't leave. That's their country. And they get up every day and go to work in conditions that are much more difficult than mine. They're much more at risk by what's going on there. So, and this is not only true of Chechnya. I remember this from Sudan. I remember this from Tajikistan. I remember this from Liberia. The people you're working with, they have no vacation from their country. That crisis, that suffering, is theirs day in and day out. And they end up inspiring you. Watching suffering does burn a person out, but watching people cope with suffering also inspires us. And I think that most of the people I work with, most of the people in Doctors Without Borders, would say that the inspiration far outweighs the tendency towards burnout. You really watch people rise, rise to the occasion. It's a real honor to work in the presence of that.
Kenneth Gluck, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you very much.
Kenneth Gluck works for the humanitarian aid organization Doctors Without Borders.